Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Dr. Ellen Stofan, NASA's chief scientist. So, Ellen, you mentioned in the previous segment that you mentioned the recent findings of Kepler, the telescope, and you also referenced the James Webb Space Telescope. I was wondering if you had any, I really would like to delve deeper into the Kepler experience. What are the implications of the findings that of its work?
Well, if you go back to this question of are we alone, there's a very famous equation called the Drake equation that looks at the potential, Frank Drake sort of looked at, can I kind of try to quantify the likelihood of there being life beyond Earth? And one of the variables is how many planets are out there. And I think while we certainly knew there were billions of stars in our galaxy and many, many billions of stars in the universe, and we certainly suspected that many of them would have planets around them, we didn't know that until Kepler. And to me, that's why Kepler has been, you know, because you can have a hypothesis, but until you have evidence, you're not really sure. And what Kepler has really told us is how common planets are. And the fact that they're so common, and the fact that Kepler has been able to detect 3 planet systems, 5 planet systems, 7 planet systems. And Kepler also has had the ability to detect planets between the size of Earth and Neptune. It had much higher resolution. Previously, we'd only been able to detect more planets the size of Jupiter or Saturn, so very large planets, which are likely to be gas giants, not likely to be habitable. But Kepler took us into that sort of habitable planet range. And it has found huge numbers of planets in that size category. That's another thing. We had no idea if that were the case. How common are Earth-sized planets? And we think that's important because of reasons of a planet being big enough to hold an atmosphere, and you need a substantial atmosphere, we think, to have life, because life needs to breathe, or it needs to have those processes. So we think you need an atmosphere if you are going to have life on the surface. So that's why the size is important. And also for the composition, you want it to have brought in lots of different materials so that life has the possibility to access lots of different chemical systems. And so Kepler, I think, has really just revolutionized our views on the potential for there being habitable planets out there.
And so when does the James Webb Space Telescope start? What's the mission? When is it operational? And what do you hope to gather from that effort?
James Webb will launch in 2018. And, you know, after a several-month checkout, it'll be ready to start taking data. And we're incredibly excited about it. It's sort of the next great observatory following on from Hubble. And it's in a different wavelength range. In the case of James Webb, it's an infrared telescope. Hubble is a visible near-infrared. James Webb has a more extended range. So again, it's giving you that different pair of eyes to get different information about the galaxy and about the universe. It'll even look at planets in our own solar system. And James Webb has a number of different focuses. It's really looking, for example, it can actually look much deeper into space. And that's critical because the deeper you look into space, the deeper in time you are looking, because the light takes so long to come from its point of origin to the telescope that in this case, we're going to actually be looking at basically just tens of millions of years after the Big Bang, which is much further back in time than we've ever been able to see before with a telescope. And so to understand what was happening in our very young universe is going to be really amazing. That's just one of the things James Webb can do. It can also look at the atmospheres of some of these extrasolar planets. So we can start asking the question, some of these planets around other stars, do they have oxygen, carbon dioxide, methane, water? These gases that here on Earth are associated with life, do we see those gases in atmospheres around planets around other stars? That's not proof that they're inhabited, but it's indicating they are potentially habitable.
So, you know, we talk about Mars, I think 2030 may have been the date that was given. So the Mars exploration program, could you tell us more about that? What's going on? What's next in this area? Are we on schedule? What are some of the challenges being faced?
You know, you have to think when you're trying to do something as difficult as get humans to Mars in the 2030s, it's a problem you really have to break into different phases and saying, which problem do I need to attack first, and how do I do this in a way that is spurring economic innovation, you know, supporting NASA's mission and really moving the country forward. So when we look at it, we say, all right, the first thing we have to do, and the, you know, job one is to make sure that we can get humans there safely and healthy. And so that's why the International Space Station is so critical, because it's that research we're doing every day on the International Space Station, buying down those human health risks. And we think by the mid-2020s, we'll be ready to go. So at that point, what we're going to be doing is moving humans out to the vicinity of the moon. Now, why not go straight to Mars at that point? You know, if you're at the moon, you can make it home in 3 or 4 days. For example, we're going to put a what we call a cislunar habitat. So we're basically going to build the prototype of the Mars transfer vehicle. So what will get humans from the Earth to the Mars system. And we're going to put it in orbit out around the moon. Because, again, we want to make sure its systems work. Do its life support systems work? Are they reliable? If things break, do we know how to fix them without having to constantly resupply from the Earth? Let's go practice that in the vicinity of the moon before we're ready to take that leap to Mars. Because once you're on your way to Mars, boy, you're on your way to Mars. So let's practice at the moon and then move on to Mars. And then by about 2032, we'll be ready to head out to Mars. One of the most important things we're doing right now is building a new rocket. We're building a new rocket called the Space Launch System. It'll be ready to launch in late 2018, not with humans on board yet, but we'll test the Space Launch System and the Orion capsule, which will sit on top of it. That's what will get humans out to the vicinity of the moon. We'll send the first crewed mission up around 2021. And again, that will lead towards doing this cislunar habitat in the mid-2020s. In the meantime, of course, we're also still studying Mars because we want to make sure, do we understand what it takes to land a lot of mass on the surface of Mars? Do we understand the dust on Mars? Its potential, is it potentially harmful to humans? Do we need to work on systems to keep that dust away from the humans that go to Mars? Do we know scientifically the best place to pick a human landing site? What are the astronauts going to do when we get there? So we have our robotic program of exploring Mars that's still continuing, and we're working very hard on that, so that we understand when the humans get there that we can make the best use out of them as explorers, as the ones who are going to go crack open those rocks and find that evidence of past life on Mars.
And you're doing your focus, NASA's focus on Mars allows for the cultivation of the commercial space area. I'd like to talk about it. What is commercial space, and how has NASA changed the way it's engaging commercial space community?
You know, NASA's always, since its inception, certainly worked with the private sector, and we've had strong commercial partners. I think what's amazing at this point is this revolution we've been going through over the past about 5 or 6 years, where we've said, okay, let's start to turn over to the private sector those aspects of space exploration that NASA really doesn't need to do anymore. Just think with communication satellites. NASA was very involved at the beginning. We're not involved at all anymore. So how can we start moving other parts of NASA into that same category so that we can focus our dollars on doing the things that nobody else wants to do or can do? So, for example, right now you have SpaceX and Orbital ATK launching cargo to the International Space Station. We've just added Sierra Nevada Corporation. They'll also start taking cargo up to the ISS. Starting in about a year, we'll have SpaceX and Boeing Corporation launching crew up to the International Space Station because we feel that those are functions that can be turned over to the private sector. Of course, we also have a really interesting partnership with SpaceX in terms of they want to land a capsule on the surface of Mars in 2018 called Red Dragon. So they want to take one of their Dragon capsules and actually send it all the way to Mars. We're extremely excited about that at NASA because to get humans down onto the surface of Mars, we have a lot more work to do on what we call entry, descent, and landing, or EDL. That's the toughest part. And Mars has this annoying atmosphere where there's enough of an atmosphere there to really heat your spacecraft up as you enter the atmosphere, but it's not enough of an atmosphere to really slow you down. So boy, do you come wailing in and you have to do a lot of work to slow yourself down. And so our very complex system that some people might have seen talked about in our 7 Minutes of Terror video that we put out before the Curiosity landing, Curiosity weighed 1 metric ton, and it was pretty difficult to land on the surface of Mars. It was a real challenge. We estimate for getting humans to the surface of Mars, you're going to be landing 10, 15, 20 metric tons on the surface. So the more we can partner with SpaceX, with other private industry that wants to help us push that technological envelope of getting humans to Mars, the happier we are. So it's a great new era, I think, of exploration. And it's not just with the private sector. We also want to partner with our international space agencies.
What are you doing to promote science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, or STEM education? And would you tell us about NASA's critical investment in these areas?
You know, to me, everything that we do, and Charlie Bolden, my boss, likes to say that, you know, every time we launch a rocket, every time we get a new image back from Pluto, or an amazing new image from Hubble showing the deep reaches of our galaxy, you know, we're inspiring that next generation. I've been to schools all over this country and all over the world, literally. And you walk into that school and the kids are vibrating with excitement because NASA has come to talk to them. And it's amazing to me what a source of inspiration. You know, kids who might not think they're interested in science all of a sudden come up to you and say, I want to be an astronaut, or I want to go understand how black holes work. And so I think NASA has an important role in making sure that everybody understands that we need all hands on deck. We need to tap into the talent of all of our population in order to solve the tough challenges we have ahead of us, whether it's getting humans to Mars or dealing with the effects of climate change. And that's why we've been particularly proud at NASA this year when the story has come out, for example, about Katherine Johnson, who's one of my huge role models and who now they're making a movie about, who was an early mathematician at NASA who helped calculate the trajectories for the Gemini and Mercury missions.
What does the future hold for scientific research at NASA? We will ask NASA's chief scientist, Dr. Ellen Stofan, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.